Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Christopher Columbus is usually seen as the rational geographer that had to do battle with the forces of ignorance and superstition in order to gain support for his enterprise of the Indies that resulted in his discovery of America. There are those, however, who insist that Columbus was a medieval apocalyptic spiritualist. So which description is more accurate? Here to help us decide is Pauline Moffitt-Watts, professor of history at Sarah Lawrence College. Professor Watts is the author of several books and articles on medieval and Renaissance religious history, including Prophecy and Discovery on the Spiritual Origins of Christopher Columbus's Enterprise of the Indies, that appeared in the American Historical Review nearly 15 years ago in 1985, but that's just as interesting today as we approach the millennium. Welcome, Professor Watts.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us. And which is it? Was Columbus the rational geographer, or was he the medieval spiritualist?
Well, I think there's not really an either-or answer to your question. Certainly, Columbus was a man of intense personal piety. He was described by his biographers as a very observant Christian. He was devoted to the cults of St. Francis and the Virgin Mary. But so were many of his contemporaries. He was certainly a superb sailor and something of a business entrepreneur, but I think that the image of him as a rational geographer and a scientific innovator is really quite a modern invention. And his knowledge of geography was based for the most part on very traditional medieval texts.
So more traditional and perhaps even more religious than we'd like to think. Or we often think, I should say.
Perhaps, yes.
Okay. Was the contest at court then, that again is often painted, goes back to Washington Irving's description, simply a showdown between the rationalist and the forces of religious dogma?
Oh, I don't think that was the case at all. I think that the issue that was up for debate was whether or not the Western Ocean Sea was navigable, and that is whether it was really feasible to reach the Far East by sailing west. So the arguments really revolved around the size of the circumference of the Earth. And the debate was about whose figures you were going to use. And the court geographers stuck to the estimates of Ptolemy, which go back to the 2nd century AD. And Columbus was presenting figures that were derived from other sources. And these sources led him to argue that the circumference of the Earth was significantly smaller than Ptolemy had estimated, and therefore it should be possible to reach the East by sailing west. Now, both sides did invoke the authority of Scripture at certain points in the debates, but this wouldn't be unusual, and the theological points they're making were really corollaries to the practical problem of, you know, how big the ocean was.
So who was actually correct on the practical question?
Well, neither one of them, really. Columbus was had actually seriously underestimated the distance. And he was probably manipulating his figures anyway because he wanted to make his case. But aside from any manipulation he might have been consciously doing, he was also wrong. So the irony is that I suppose that the voyage was made with the supposition that the actual distance was much shorter than it was.
And yet he made a discovery and ironically thought it was the Orient and turned out to be much more important in time.
That's right.
Interesting situation. Tell us about his Book of Prophecies. What was it and what was that all about?
Well, the Book of Prophecies is a compilation of excerpts of passages from Scripture and the Apocrypha, from patristic medieval commentators, and a hodgepodge of other materials, including prophecies, which were then circulating in European courts. And it also contains a letter from Columbus to Ferdinand and Isabella, defending the enterprise of the Indies as being divinely preordained. It's a very difficult manuscript to decipher because there are annotations in a number of hands, probably five of them, and they include Columbus's hand and the hand of his son, and also a collaborator, a monk, a Carthusian monk by the name of Gaspar Garicio. And actually, there are now modern editions and translations of the text, so it's possible to look at it. It's still difficult to make sense of it, however.
Is it difficult to decipher? And maybe I could follow that question with, as a result, do you think this was perhaps more the work of the monk than Columbus?
Well, we're not sure. There's been scholarly debate on that. It's difficult to decipher because what you've really got is a collection of texts and annotations in different hands, and you don't have a coherent, integrated body of writing. You've got a kind of work in progress.
So why did he write it? What was its purpose?
Here's what either he or his collaborator, Goricio, says. I'm going to give you a quote from it. It says that the book is a collection of authorities, sayings, opinions, and prophecies concerning the need to recover the holy city and Mount Zion and the discovery and the conversion of the islands of the Indies and all the peoples and nations for Ferdinand and Isabella, our Spanish rulers. So that's what it says it is. So in other words, I take that to mean that it was Columbus's explanation of his vision of history and prophecy to Ferdinand and Isabella, and it was a vision in which he believed that he and his regents were predestined to play crucial roles.
Okay, I want to come back to that element again, but what you're suggesting here is perhaps that in his describing his vision, that perhaps it was meant to be a public relations kind of document.
Yes, I think in part it was.
And some suggest that they feel it was written after Columbus had lost favor at court. Do you subscribe to that school or not?
I do in part. I think it's a complicated matter in a complicated context. The first time we've got the Book of Prophecies mentioned is in letters between Columbus and Goricio in 1501. And in those letters, Columbus indicates he's already been working on the project for some time. And certainly the book incorporates texts which we know he read prior to the first voyage of 1492. So I think that the idea was brewing over a period of some years. On the other hand, I also think that the book was an occasional piece in that it was designed to preserve and enhance the status of the court of Ferdinand and Isabella, and it was a status which after the third voyage had seriously deteriorated because the third voyage was a disaster, and he was returned to Spain in chains under an indictment for the breakdown in his administration of the island of Hispaniola. So, you see, it's a complicated thing. It's certainly, I think, triggered by the deterioration of his status, but also it's something he had been thinking and reading about for quite a few years.
Okay, so what was, in brief, Columbus's vision here, his apocalyptic vision?
Well, in brief, it's this. He read a number of things on the interrelationships between history and astrology and prophecy, which led him to calculate there were only 155 years left before the world would end. And during that span of time, there were certain prophecies that remained to be fulfilled. And among them is the prophecy that an emperor messiah figure is going to appear to lead Christian resistance to the Antichrist and to recover the Holy Land from what he called the sons of Ishmael. And so he believed that Ferdinand and Isabella together were this messiah figure, and that they were going to lead this final reconquest of the Holy Lands. And he also believed that all infidels would have to be converted to Christianity before the end of time. And that obviously squares with the passage I read you, and it squares with his annotations to these other texts he was reading and other letters that he wrote. So this is sort of core of his apocalyptic vision.
So his enterprise is really part of a much larger concept then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what role did he see himself, again, maybe we could emphasize that, what role did he see himself playing in this
right.
enterprise or in this vision?
Well, he sees himself as what he comes to call himself the Christ bearer, which is actually a kind of literal translation of Christopher, his given name. And he sees himself as a kind of saint, a second Saint Christopher. and he believes that he has been preordained to carry the message of Christianity across the sea. You see, so the enterprise of Indies also is involving the exporting of Christianity. And he's going to carry Christianity across the ocean sea, just like St. Christopher, the converted pagan giant, once carried the Christ child across a turbulent river. And he also believes that the enterprise of the Indies is going to open the sea route, which Ferdinand and Isabella can use to take their forces to the Holy Land and to reconquer it for the Christians, you say.
Did he see himself as playing a part in the follow-up events to his enterprise to the Indies?
Well, there are letters which indicate that he wanted to lead a fleet of an army to sort of a back door, as it were, you see, to go around all the way, sail all the way around via the ocean sea and creep up on the Holy Land from behind. And I think he wanted to be the leader of that expedition.
Any indication of that he go to his grave with this idea in mind?
It seems that way. It's hard to document it precisely. I think he did.
Okay.
I think he did.
And was his apocalyptic view unique or unusual for the time, or was this kind of in the air at the end of the 15th century?
Well, I don't think that his apocalypticism is so idiosyncratic as people suppose. His views are certainly anchored in a very rich and complex legacy of medieval political ideology. So, actually, in developing this self-image as Christopherens over a period of several decades, he was probably doing it in part precisely because of the political and the religious resonances it would have at the court of Ferdinand and Isabella. In other words, it would serve to advantageously situate his accomplishments and his proposals within the agendas and the forms of propaganda operating at the court. So I don't think he was so unusual as people have sometimes supposed.
And did any of this ever come up in his conversations at court? I know you don't have the complete record, but is this something that was ever publicly debated?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, I mean, did his vision, did he ever have to answer to this to some of the clerics at court as to his idea of his prophecy?
Well, yeah, I think he was constantly pressing his interest and trying to preserve his image, especially after 1501. And there were all kinds of contacts and conversations. But I think if you look at it from, say, the perspective of Ferdinand and Isabella, as distinct from that of Columbus, they have a very complex program of governance that they are engaged in, with all kinds of proposals and other problems coming to their ears. So sometimes I think we tend to magnify Columbus's presence and forget that, especially after his fortune sort of deteriorated, he became a more peripheral figure, and they were more interested in establishing the colonial enterprise aside from him or without him.
Well, let me take you down the road of magnifying Columbus, to use your words. What is the explanation in your mind for the persistent popular perception of Columbus as this rational geographer when we really know that he's quite different from that?
Well, I know something of the history of it. I think actually it's a perception which has diminished somewhat. My students tell me now that that's not the way things are taught in high school. But I think the perception you're talking about was really invented in the 19th century, and there's been some study of it. And scholars see it as connected to really a cluster of forces at work in academic and literary and educational circles. There's the rise of interest in science and scientific method and the belief that history is progressive. And these ideas are coupled with anti-religious sentiment, and especially anti-medievalism, because the Middle Ages is seen as the great age of spirituality and superstition. So science gets linked to freedom and progress, and religion gets linked to superstition. And you mentioned Washington Irving a few minutes ago, and all these factors come together, and they're all at work in Irving's famous biography, The History of the Life and Voyages of Columbus, which came out in 1828. And Irving simply made up his own version of Columbus's debates with the scholars at the court of Ferdinand and Isabella. And he wasn't the only one to make up this kind of fiction. And then these fictitious accounts got taken over into children's school books. And so gradually, fiction assumes the guise of fact. And it's a fiction which is quite widely disseminated in schools in the 19th and even into the early 20th century. So I think that's why it lasts, is because it's embedded in what children are reading, what they're being taught in school.
Yeah, widely disseminated and embedded. You may remember Claudia Bushman's book a few years back on Columbus. She argues that it was so embedded because it really rang true to people. It was how they wanted to imagine him and themselves.
Yes, I think that has something to do with it. His image has always shifted according to the needs of writers and politicians, and not only in the United States, but in Spain and in England. It's a fascinating story of how he has been kind of invented and reinvented.
Well, I shouldn't let you go with at least weighing in on the question that comes up every time we talk about Columbus, this idea about Columbus proving the world was round rather, and again, contending with the forces
right.
That insisted it was flat. Myth?
Oh, yes. And actually, it's a myth that comes out of the same 19th century environment that produces this distorted image of Columbus. It's really an invention of scholars who misuse sources to suit their own agendas, which in many cases were anti-medieval. And again, it filtered down into textbooks and was quite widely taught in the 19th and early 20th centuries. There's a wonderful book about this, the Flat Earth. It's Jeffrey Burton Russell. It's called Inventing the Flat Earth, Columbus and Modern Historians. Do you know that book?
I do.
It's a great thing to read if you want a quick kind of survey of how the notion of the flat Earth came into existence and why it survived as long as it did.
Well, have to close on that note, but thank you for being with us, and appreciate your thoughts on Columbus.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Pauline Moffitt-Watts, Professor of History at Sarah Lawrence College, and this is Talking History.